May it please the court, my name is John Gazzoli. I have 3 points I want to make in my time this morning after I give a very brief summary of what I think the important evidence is. At the time of the hearing in this case, Huck's Door Fixture Company was a startup business. It had no history of production or customer business. They started in November 1995 with 15 employees. 1 year later, they had 185 employees doing production work. The company worked very hard to build that business, and they had a huge order from Borders Bookstores in the summer of 1996, which involved a lot of overtime and extra shifts, which they shipped sometime in October. As of the 1st of November, 96, first year after they had done business, they'd shipped their orders, their production staff was way too large, they stopped working overtime, they stopped working extra shifts. They probably should have done a layoff at that time, but they didn't do that. They made a determination to build some inventory to hopefully avoid similar problems the following year, but they had no way to anticipate what would happen. They also decided to use some people to fix up a residence that the company owned. So when we get to the 1st of February, 1997, this is before any union activity was aware, or the company was aware of that. February 1st, 1997, they had accumulated $2.1 million in inventory and had gone through their credit line at the bank, and basically that's how they were financing the buildup of inventory. And Mr. Prock decided at that time to analyze the specific production requirements going forward. This was before any knowledge of union activity. On the 4th of February, he purchased airline tickets for his senior staff to visit their customers up in Michigan and Oklahoma. On the 18th and 19th, those trips were made. On the 20th, he had a meeting with his production manager and basically came up with calculations based on how many people they had at work at that time, what their production was going to be needed in light of the inventory they'd build up for the following 6 months, determined they had 25% excess capacity. That's the basis for the layoff decision. They went through the process after that to determine.
When did you begin using the term attitude to determine the in your evaluation program?
That concept had been used for years by Mr. Prock and his other company. It was not something that was added for this time. That's a very common thing to judge a worker by their attitude. That was not added for that purpose in this case. Anyway.
Why were the 10 temporary employees hired by the company in the middle of the reduction of one-fifth of the workforce?
Because they were rated higher on the evaluations than the others.
But doesn't that call into question the legitimacy of the company's need to reduce the size of its workforce?
No, I don't think it does. Because what they did was they determined who were the best workers there. Some of these people had probably been employed when they did evaluations earlier, late in 1996, but they didn't have the 300-hour requirement. It's interesting that the board is seeking remedy because we terminated and sent back some temporaries. And it's inconsistent for them to take the position that it's also wrong for you to have hired some temporaries. So they're the ones that are taking an inconsistent position on this.
Well, but when the ostensible reason for laying off and discharging is too much inventory, and the company is hiring, as Judge Coffey just noted, 10 of the temporary employees for permanent production. Doesn't that call into question?
Only if you're the NLRB does it call into question. If I'm running a company, I want the best workers I can have, and that's basically what they did. They had a very objective evaluation process. The temporaries went through the process. Those that could be hired, okay, and had already worked 300 hours there, as well as the regular employees.
Yes, but if there's too much inventory, you don't need any of them, do you?
Well, that's the point. They needed to reduce their workforce by 25%, and they need to find out which are the least productive 25%. It could be 20%, actually, the way the math works out. And those were the ones that were let go for that 4-month period. Why would any company want to go with less productive employees.
You know, the anti-union bias that you see in this record is about as strong as I've seen any case in this court. Should that have any effect on the decision of the other issues?
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
You haven't been here.
Pardon me?
How did you know what he said? You haven't sat here for 20 years.
Well, I understand that. My point is that the only evidence they've got of Mr. Prock's anti-union bias is him standing up on a picnic bench telling his employees he was opposed to unionization. And that's protected activity. He has a right to do that. Now, these lower-level supervisors were all instructed by him not to do any interrogation, not to do this, not to do that. And they had nothing to do with the decision regarding the layoffs and the reduction in force.
Why was it necessary to tell his supervisors not to do that?
Why was it necessary?
Yeah.
Because he wanted to make sure that they wouldn't...
Did reflect his attitude?
Pardon me?
He thought the supervisors might reflect his attitude?
I don't understand that, Your Honor. His attitude was, we don't want to do anything improper. That's why counsel was involved in coming up with these evaluations.
What's the standard of review for us in this case?
It's the normal universal camera, substantial evidence on the record, and we addressed that in our brief. And frankly, I don't see this case being any different. Judge Coffey, you were involved in that Vulcan basement waterproofing case. You were involved in the Six West Limited case on the panels for those cases. To me, this case is very similar to that Vulcan basement waterproofing case. The standard of review, the board has to make a prima facie case. The employer has an obligation at that point to come forward with evidence. Let me get to the three points I want to make. First, the board's decision, as it's written, cannot be enforced. Why? Because when you analyze the discriminatory discharge issues, you look at the employer's stated business justification reason, which in this case was inventory buildup. Neither the ALJ nor the board even analyzed that. They didn't understand it. What happened then,
What do you mean they didn't understand it?
They didn't. They didn't address inventory buildup. They talked about cash flow, and they talked about business deterioration, neither of which was mentioned.
What you mean is that they didn't have the same interest that you had. They were impartial.
Oh, I don't think so. This is our burden, our evidentiary proof. We came forward and we said we have too much inventory. And the extensive evidence that was put on the record, all the business records, all the amount of inventory on a monthly basis, all the production numbers, were unrebutted. And now what we have right now, which is point number two, recognizing that the ALJ and the board itself did not address these things, now we have counsel for the NLRB saying, well, let's look at the inventory buildup, and I think failing miserably because they can't find a hole in that. And they realize now that there was a serious problem. When you examine the employer's business justification evidence, all the evidence on this record supports that. And it's ludicrous to think that this company would lay off 33 people, 25% of its workforce, for 4 months, operate without any overtime, no new hires, 17-18% attrition in that time, and still meet customer orders. If they needed those people to do the work, they would have done it, and they would have been able to sell that product then. They didn't need them.
Thank you. All right, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is William Bernstein. I'm counsel for the National Labor Relations Board. Before I get started, I'd like very quickly to invite the court's attention to an inadvertent error on page 29 of the board's brief. That's about seven lines down. During 1966, the company sold Domino $1.74 million worth of fixtures. I apologize to the court. That is supposed to be $1,740. And that's a significant difference, of course.
I would say it is.
Also, at the very last sentence of the on that page, page 29, it should be Respondent's Exhibit 31 rather than General Counsel's Exhibit 31. I'm confident that these errors were discovered in the course of reading the record, but I nevertheless apologize. The company's asserted reason for the layoff of 20% of its workforce is contradicted by its own statements to its employees and even the testimony of its own president, Mr. Prock. First of all, in January, Mr. Prock told the employees, business is good and there's not much to worry about. He told this to the employees, not to any kind of shareholders or bank or anything like that. He assembled the employees, and when you tell the employees that we're doing well and there's not much to worry about, that's another way of saying your jobs are safe.
You know, the company emphasized in its brief, and Mr. Cazzoli emphasized today, that the board, that both the ALJ and the board really have misunderstood or misrepresented the reasons why the company concluded that there was a need to reduce its workforce. And that it was not a problem with cash flow, and it was not a drop-off in business, but rather an excessive build-up in inventory that the company cited the reason for the layoffs and discharges. Did the ALJ and the board make some mistakes here in characterizing the company's rationale? And if so, how would that impact on our review at this stage?
To answer the first part of your question, it was not ignored. It was, in a board decision as in a court decision, not every single defense of the respondent is written about or talked about in the decision. Now, the company brought the defenses that it brings before this court were brought to the attention of the board. If they weren't, then this court would not even have jurisdiction to hear them because of Section 10E of the Act prohibits making contentions before the court that weren't made before the board. And although the board, the administrative law judge and the board didn't go into great detail as far as crunching numbers, it basically both decisions, the decision of the ALJ and the board, said the company says it was overstaffed and this defense is without any credibility.
Is it your view that no errors were made here? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, on what basis do you contend that the company's average daily production figures were artificially inflated?
Well, first of all, the
in other words, what evidence do you have of this inflation?
The company took 151 days, which is the number of work days between February 20th, 1997 and October 31st, 1997, and came up with a figure of $45,000 per day of production multiplied by 151. In doing that, the company used inflated figures from a grossly disproportionate period of time in which the daily production level exceeded 100,000 in some cases. This skewed their projection, whereas had they used a more representative sample, including November and December, it would have been considerably lower and considerably closer to the $35,000 figure. That was their method, and the method was simply not representative. It was inflated.
Can we talk about the evaluations for a minute or two? Will the record tell us whether the company was giving union supporters lower scores on criteria such as attitude, such that it would be obvious that the evaluations were being conducted in a discriminatory manner?
No, I don't think the record indicates that, but let me call the court's attention to page 12 of the company's, the opening brief, in which they list a number of employees. These are the employees, 8 full-time company employees and 3 temporary employees from Snelling. who were let go, and they have the comparative scores. In November, Mr. Borson scored 25, and in February 1970, he scored 19, and so on.
Yeah,
so
see, I'm wondering if that that's my question, really. If the difference came into play because of attitude.
The record doesn't indicate that was a factor. What the record does clearly indicate, though, is that, for example, only 6% of those employees who signed the anti-union petition were let go, whereas 27% of those who didn't were. And this group that I referred to that was let go on the 4th of March, of the 8 full-time company employees, 5 of them were card signers. Later on March the 11th, when 10 people were laid off, when 12 people were laid off, 10 of those were card signers.
You know, the company suggested that the evaluation form that was used in February was actually more objective in terms of how it assessed attendance, and that otherwise the evaluation was really hardly any different.
Well,
a fair representation?
I suppose it's, as far as it goes, it is, but as we pointed out in the brief, it's not the the actual intrinsic characteristics of the evaluation itself. It's the way it was used. And how it was used here is, admittedly by the company, it was used as a criterion for determining who lost their jobs. And number two, clearly, this whole layoff business was an unlawful layoff for many reasons that I won't go into detail about now. And because they used this not intrinsically fair evaluation system for the unlawful purpose of ridding itself of through a mass layoff of a number of employees, that makes it an unlawful part of an unlawful scheme. The second part of that is, as I said, the results were very grossly disproportionate, favoring the layoffs and discharge of people who had supported the union. Finally, I'd like to say that the company's asserted defense is contradicted by its own statements and the testimony of its president. Even in February, and this is important, after painting a rosy picture for the employees in January and saying, in effect, your jobs are safe, then at the critical time, around the time that the company allegedly made this layoff and discharge decision, around February 20th, Prock himself testified that the company, and I quote, had the core business of Phillips, Borders, Kmart, and Domino's to sustain the number of workers there. That's plain language from the mouth of the company president, that they had enough work so that he wouldn't have to get rid of anybody. They could sustain them. To sustain the numbers of workers there, plus going out and getting some business. I thought it looked a lot better than it did a year earlier. Then he goes on to say, so the difference between the first part of January and the end of February was not that significant, but yet there was enough that we had to make some changes. Well, the some changes that they made was to jettison 20% of their workforce, and to do it 7 days after, upon learning about the union activities, President Prock jumped up on a bench and waved an authorization card around and voiced his strong opposition to the union. And on that same day, the company launched a relentless series of coercive activities, threats of discharge, plant closure, you name it, running the gamut of coercive conduct. What caused the change between January and February? Well, there's a big elephant in the living room here, and it's the union. That was the only thing that changed from January to February.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Just a few comments there. First, as to your comment about anti-union animus, the company hired 100 people that worked for the predecessor company, knowing full well that they were members of the carpenters union. There was no anti-union animus at any time in the actual decision-making of how that company was run. Mr. Bernstein talked about what Mr. Pratt told his employees in January. He forgets to say Mr. Pratt told them we were building inventory at that time. He was very clear about that, and that's exactly consistent with everything else that we've said all along. The NLRB did ignore the inventory buildup issue in its ALJ decision and the board decision. What do they do instead? They looked at these two business justification reasons, which we did not advance, cash flow and deterioration in business, and then proceeds to find those were pretextual when we never advanced them in the first place. As far as the calculations that Mr. Hammond did, why would the production manager want to look at anything but his current production? They say, well, he should have gone back to September and October and all that. That's not right. Finally, on the temps, one thing I want you to keep in mind, many of those temps may have been working there longer than the regular employees. They may have been working there longer. They had to work there for 300 hours before they could be hired.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement and proceed to case number 2, please.